Welcome to the HC Insider Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the commodities sector and the people within it. I'm your host, Paul Chapman. Today we're talking forecasting. The energy and commodities sector has moved on from the stable world of low volatility and low prices of the last decade into a new world of high volatility, driven by not only factors within the sector, but also outside. How has that changed the nature of forecasting? What does it mean for skill sets, tools, and models? And are the markets still forecastable? Our guest is Matteo Mazzoni. Matteo is the Director of Energy Analytics at ICIS, an independent commodity intelligence service that provides data analytics in the chemicals and energy sector. As always, you can really support the show by leaving a positive review on the platform you're listening on, ideally a written review, or a thumbs up on YouTube, as it really helps grow our following and thereby allow us to continue to get great guests. And as always, I hope you enjoy the episode. Matteo, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul. I'm very excited to be here.
So we are talking forecasting and the art of forecasting, which of course is the very essence of trading, and how that's changed, and how particularly it's changed most recently in the wake of such volatility coming from factors within the sector, but also outside, such as geopolitical volatility. But to tell that story, I think it'd be great if we could start kind of, you know, we'll pick sort of any rough date in the last 20 years prior to COVID, where, you know, the world was a more stable place. And just to get some sense from you about the sort of the tools and methods of how traders and trading organizations went about forecasting future prices.
Absolutely. I think, obviously I'm biased, but it's a fascinating topic. And probably the starting point of it, especially when we think about forecasting, is to understand the mere nature of it as a continuous exercise that tries to anticipate the evolution of a specific market. In this case, we're talking about the energy market, but effectively is a constant recalibration of the underlying condition. There is a very interesting book called The Experience Machine by Andy Clark, which states something along the lines of, we see the world by predicting the world, and where prediction errors ensue, we must predict again. And that is, in a nutshell, energy forecasting and forecasting in general. I think this premise is essential to understand how energy forecasting has evolved over time. And without going too far into the past, I think that we could start looking at the energy world in the previous two decades, when we started to see some interesting breaks into historical trends, and mostly when markets have started to operate. Because while we kind of take for granted the nature of energy markets nowadays, and as we know them, their invention is quite a recent phenomenon. In fact, up until 20 years ago, energy was mainly probably something in the hands of government. So there was a market, but it was a market among different states. Then a wave of liberalization hit the world between the 90s and the early 2000s. And many energy markets started to open up to a lot of private companies and to effectively energy trading as we know it. It was a gradual, say, process that was somehow matched also by the evolution of forecasting in general. So we started off by applying, you know, regression models to specific markets, because they were all like isolated and in many cases confined to national boundaries. Then over time, with you know, the deregulation, with more players coming into the market, the whole set of tools that were needed started to change. And also we started to have more and more access to data, which was somehow very scarce at the beginning. And we could start to forecasting all different markets looking at their own dynamics, moving past just, you know, simple regression models to something more sophisticated, something a little bit more nerdy with, you know, machine learning algorithms that were applied to try to forecast short-term dynamics that could be somehow exploited by the trading side of any business.
I mean, it's never been easy, right? But essentially, if I understand what you're saying, the 20 years ago, you would have a, you know, supply and demand analyst, and you'd use mathematical tools, regressions, bunch of independent variables, see which ones were significant. But you had essentially the data set was bounded and less complex, you know, than it is today, because in part those markets were much more bounded and there was less data. But, you know, over time, of course, we've introduced machine learning, which is essentially doing those regression models just many, many more of them are much faster and adapting more quickly. But we're still talking about a relatively stable world, right? The forecasting was usually, it could be accurate because ultimately the markets themselves were relatively stable. There were sort of known entities, known quantities, known policies and so forth. So it was, you know, you could apply new technologies and there's a lot more data, but we hadn't yet kind of reached where we are today, where just we'll come on to that. But is that a fair assessment, that it was essentially a general improvement of tools and data, but we still had these markets that, while they were getting more complex and more interwoven, they were still, relatively speaking, forecastable?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the difficulty at the beginning was to get data because there was not a lot of history, rather than to build models. Great part of the initial forecasting was that at a macro level. And if we even look at all the different markets, you had, you know, the coal and oil market that were already pretty established in a sense, but still few players operating in those markets. So dynamics could be somehow mapped out and replicated in a sense. But when it was about, you know, the gas market or power markets, because there still isn't a single power market as a whole. There were fairly new inventions and were mainly, they characterized by new investments coming. So as you correctly say, it was a pretty stable world, which was characterized by a general oversupply of infrastructure, of capacity, both existing and new ones. And each market operated in its own, let's say, space without necessarily with clear boundaries and with traders trading one commodity and not multiple commodities all at once as it is today. That allowed energy prices to, you know, a combination of not a lot of players, isolated markets, a general oversupply that allowed energy prices to remain pretty stable for years, with just a little bit of volatility and uncertainty needed to keep things interesting. And it was actually, there was the perfect setup for the first boom of energy trading and the first expansion of energy forecast. And that meant basically, I would say, two things. As you said, on one side, early applications of machine learning algorithms for short-term signals. And on the other side, the build-up of energy planning models. So big models that could start forecasting the evolution, the future evolution of energy markets according to the new drive, which was, you know, the energy transition.
Yeah, so you've got these ever-increasing sort of ability to forecast in the very short term via machine learning models. We've covered those elsewhere. But these macro models, and you've kind of got this one big story, which is essentially the energy transition. And really, it's kind of about sort of these longer-range forecasts of that adoption and the timelines for that, right? And let's just dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that it was kind of, let's say, stark division. On one side, short-term models pretty much automated, trying to look for that bit of volatility. I mean, if you consider, for example, gas prices in the second half of the 21st century, so the previous decade, they move between a very narrow range. We're talking about, you know, for example, the Dutch TTF, ICS TTF price, which we assessed, it traded for 10 years between 15 euros and 25 euros, more or less. We're talking about a very, very narrow range. Well, on the other side, there was the new wave of investment coming for the energy transition with a lot of renewables coming to market, and you need bigger and bigger models built and connected for capturing the future evolution of energy systems. So the real forecast was the long-term one. So forecasting how the energy transition might happen. That introduced new variables like policy and regulatory measures. Technology was essentially a new variable, especially when we talked about, you know, solar, wind, and other technologies. Now, let's say recently, there is a lot of interest between the interplay of hydrogen batteries and more. But at some point, I don't know if you remember, it was mainly about getting the rate of renewable deployment right. I think that you can still find a line. At some point, the International Energy Agency started to track its own photovoltaic upward revisions. So they started to track how many each year by how much they had to revise upwards the solar build out, the solar deployment, because the market kept beating anybody's expectations.
And as you say, right, the volatility becomes very much at the very short term, and you're trying to capture as much of that. There wasn't the sort of the big macro moves, as it was a stable environment, and then it came down to, as you say, renewable energy systems and their deployment. Then, and I guess, but there's the philosophical angle to this discussion, which is, you know, what's the state of forecasting at the end of this discussion, and is it still possible and all the rest of it? But essentially, we have sort of a chasm starts to develop quite quickly, you know, triggered by COVID, but there were some events prior, you know, around the geopolitics piece that was signaling this, where essentially you had this vast gulfs open up between predictions and reality, and the frequency of those gulfs increase as well. So in sort of planning for this episode, we were talking about which ones we could pick, and carbon's a really good example of where there's been some of those, that huge volatility. But can you just, I guess, you know, when did we start seeing real volatility return to the market, and can we sort of start off on a couple of examples around the gap that's opened up?
I think that I'm not going to be very original in this answer, but the two big examples or easy ones that we can use to look at where the market actually broke and where people started to reassess the models that they had built. It was, the first one was COVID, and the second one was definitely, you know, more the invasion of Ukraine in, let's say, 2 years ago. And, you know, there's the assumption that the future will be similar to the past generally beats a lot of expert forecasts as a general rule, but it also introduces the risk of over extrapolating and the risk of, let's say, failing at recognizing regression towards the mean or any potential break in between. And COVID, for the very first time, added something to the natural forecasting of energy forecasting that was not so strong in the past, which is the demand side. So now we know that, as in any market, the price is the result of a supply and demand balance, but that balance can easily be disrupted by external events, and COVID was essentially one. But when the pandemic started to unravel and forced lockdowns across the globe, before even disrupting, you know, entire supply chains, we immediately realized that a lot of models failed at forecasting the change in demand. We did not have the right tools at that time for that. And all the, let's say, most of the machine learning algorithms trained started to show their limits. So for the first time since 2008, we had to go back and look at energy demand and started to look at, let's say similar events in the past or similar breaks in the past or in order to actually calculate what was the potential demand drop and how that, could have impacted the price and what was the nature of the rebound out of something that was completely unknown as the pandemic and all the lockdowns.
It's kind of fascinating, isn't it? Because, and I do want to talk about a couple of examples, but there's sort of this seismic shift from kind of Francis Fukuyama's book, The End of History. And this was true kind of across society, right? It was actually, yes, the past was a better predictor of the future. Things were relatively stable. There was a march forward to global free trade. And of course, no one's going to go to war because that would have a economic impact and so forth. And we also had a very low interest rate environment. And obviously, that was the environment that all of these machine learning algos were trained in. And also, many of the senior supply and demand analysts, much of the capability that organizations had in the trading world, they'd scaled down their teams in analytics, particularly for long range forecasting. They'd scaled down their sort of political advisory engagement that they would have. So not only were these, you look back, we've always had these kind of events. There's always been major shocks to the system. We haven't obviously seen so many at once, but actually a lot of the learning from the historical cycles had departed these trading teams, and many, as you say, the algos weren't prepared for it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that there was a wider recognition that something big was happening, and as we tend to do as humans, you start realizing that something has changed only when you actually face it or when it hits you. So lots of companies had to drop or even scrap different investments or past investments into forecasting methodology, forecasting models, and restart afresh. And that was, I think COVID was definitely a turning point. The invasion of Ukraine was something that forced basically everybody to do that, because it was simply impossible to make sense of the 350 euro per megawatt hour gas price that we had in August 2022. It was simply unforecastable. And so that forced everybody to go back and review their own models, review their own methodologies. And we also changed our direction and went back, or let's say tried to pare back a lot of the, say, simulation models that were not used in the past anymore.
There's a sort of reversion back to fundamentals and so forth. I mean, it's a complex story, because as well in this period that many organizations, it's not like forecasting is useless, actually, because a lot of organizations have ceased to hedge in the same, and we saw that story play out in Europe, right? Because there was a fundamental belief in stable prices. Why bother with expensive hedges? And many fell very foul of that. But also, actually, those organizations that had trading capabilities during COVID, and this was very publicly seen by the results of, organizations like BP that had very strong trading platforms, weathered the volatility so much better, right? So, it's, even imperfect forecasts, recognition that there could be this volatility and the skill sets to manage it is crucial. And that's actually feeding a lot of the dynamic that we're seeing today in the markets. The other sort of comment is, and let's take carbon, right? So carbon, it works both ways, doesn't it? Because you also have more assets, different types of participants in the market. Lots of commodities are now asset classes in their own right, whereas they weren't 15 years ago. Many more people have access to the market, and this is part of that financialization story that we've been covering on the podcast as well. But carbon, prior to Russia's invasion and even in the lead up, sort of the expectation was carbon prices were going up. They were at an all-time high. The kind of the rough theory, and it sounds intelligible, would be that if the invasion would happen, that would mean Europe would have to burn more coal and so forth, and therefore require more carbon credits, and so the price would go up in the absence of cheap Russian natural gas. When the invasion happened, the very next day the markets plummeted, causing lots of traders to be caught off guard. You know, I mean, again, it's kind of, that's an example of where even the fundamentals, you know, were wrong for other reasons outside of necessarily even the commodities sector.
Yes, and I think you picked a very, very interesting case. The carbon market is super interesting and fascinating. If you look at its whole history, you know, it was something that was supposed to be very local, especially in Europe with the emission trading system. You had, you know, utilities and industries playing in that, but effectively just one side trading carbon, which was the power side, so utilities, because obviously industrials were given a lot of allowances for free. So it was just about, let's say, banking on those for future needs or cashing out whenever it was needed. But there was a first break happening, let's say, more or less just before COVID or after COVID, in those, let's say, early 2020, 2021, when a lot of financials started to see the carbon market as an interesting one, because the policy landscape changed and it was much more predictable with the MSR, the Market Stability Reserve, and all the different rules that were somehow agreed for phase four. And that changed the old game. You had a new set of players which operated with different incentives, with a different strategy. And as you say, when Russia invaded Ukraine, the market plummeted because the expectation was, on one side, utilities, you know, ramping up with coal use, but on the other side, there was massive fear of industrials not producing, obviously stopping factories and stuff like that, massive economic downturn, and so the fear of allowances coming back to the market, so pushing the price down, which again is based on the fact of having different expectations related to a totally different set of players which were not directly involved by energy fundamentals, so to say. And in that sense, one interesting approach that for example we have always used for carbon, which is sort of distinctive for ICAS, is to look at fundamentals, but pair that with the agent-based modeling. So the idea of creating agents with specific decision rules and let them trade among themselves. So having different incentives and see what's the result of those different incentives, how that, you know, plays out in terms of trading dynamics.
The HC Insider podcast is brought to you by HC Group, a retained search, intelligence and advisory firm focused solely on the global energy and commodity sector. With 6 locations across Asia, Europe and the Americas and over 50 consultants. To find out more, go to our website, hcgroup.global. There, you can also sign up for our HC Insider content for more interviews and white papers on relevant trends and talent impacts in the commodities world.
Taking that, right, so you can model relatively effectively sort of other market participants' incentives. The bit that I guess we're now, and we're in the wake of, say, the US administration pausing new liquefaction construction in the US Gulf Coast. I mean, the world has become, you know, energy as in, you know, as a result of COVID or largely tied to COVID has become now very much part of national security, you know, in the eyes of governments around the world. You also have the energy transition and how there's a reshaping, a massive restructuring of the global economy, which is going to change, and the timelines are uncertain, but it will change the nature and makeup of supply chains that are crucial to that. It will, you know, change the landscape in terms of, as we've covered on this podcast, whatever the time frame, you know, oil might be much far less important, less attention paid to Gulf states than, say, particular, you know, China's supply chain or particular resource rich nations in Africa or whatever it might be. How do you go about today forecasting, not just looking at market participants, not just looking at data sets that, you know, over the last 10 years, 5 years, the last 3 years, but interweaving into those forecasts all of the political actors now that are based in those decisions and recognizing that they can have dramatic consequences? It's very hard to predict an invasion, which seems to go against all least economic reasons and, you know, and so forth. I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm sort of fascinated in how the models cope with that. Or is it kind of models are great, but it's yes and type behaviors now?
The idea of trying to forecast something and then constantly recalibrate what you're forecasting on based upon how the market, all markets develop. And I think that it's a fascinating development to witness. Because the liberalization of energy markets and the idea that there is one common drive, which is the energy transition and, let's say, the technological evolution that is supporting that, is resulting in markets becoming more and more intertwined and obviously much more complex compared to what they used to be. So the gas market is a striking example. We used to have, say, regional markets. We used to consider the gas market as the US market, the European market, and the Asian market, which was predominantly Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. Over time, the Asian market has evolved to something much bigger than just those three nations. China is de facto right now, but it's confirmed as the main LNG importer globally. There are other countries in Asia that have become major importer of LNG, and the invasion of the Ukraine essentially resulting in, you know, Europe becoming more and more LNG dependent. So we are in a situation where there is not that big division, or that let's say those buyers that limited the different regions in the past are no longer there, because the US is now exporting LNG to Europe, but obviously that can easily be exported somewhere else whenever there is a price incentive for that. Europe is de facto competing against Asian countries to attract LNG, not just from the US, but also from other areas. And LNG is a big driver of the gas market. The gas market is still driving power price, especially in a lot of countries in Europe, but not just in Europe, in the US as well. It's become the main source of power generation. Other countries in Asia are looking at that as well. And in that, there is an element of, you know, having carbon, especially in Europe, but not just in Europe, as the cherry on top, which drives the switch between the different fossils. So it effectively tells you, the carbon price tells you whether it's more convenient to burn gas instead of coal, or, let's say, import electricity from somewhere else where it's CO2-free or the cost is lower. So the energy market has effectively become what is commonly known as a complex adaptive system. What does that mean? It means that you have a lot of agents, a lot of companies, a lot of traders operating in that market. It means that the market is adaptive, so those agents operate with decisions rules, and those rules reflect how they think about the world and how the world works, but they constantly change as the environment changes. And the system as a whole is more than the sum of the single parts. And in order to forecast that, you cannot just rely on one model. You need to have different models that they communicate, they talk among each other. And the interesting, one of the most interesting approach, obviously, is to combine machine learning. So the different, let's say, elements connected to let's say, what is now rebranded as AI. So machine learning effectively in forecasting has always been a sort of AI. With, you know, the simulation side. So when you start having, you know, starting building on fundamentals, you try to build different universes, different worlds, and how the different agents can operate in those different worlds.
How is that, I mean, the human element, right? How, I'm sort of fascinated by, because I don't think we're really seeing this trend yet. We're obviously seeing a lot of demand for political advisory firms, you know, and sort of intelligence advisory firms, and, you know, our own expert network, Enco Insights, you know, seeing a lot of demand for people who have sort of these, you know, the regional expertise, and that expertise being, you know, over the long term as well, to capture sort of more than just a 5-year data set, which doesn't really represent the world today. You know, how do you go about getting the insight? What people does it take, and how are teams changing to be able to say, okay, you know, this is what the sort of the political landscape now looks like in Taiwan, right? This is how these elections are going to affect this. This is, you know, you leaning on a recent pod, if so and so gets elected in India, we can expect there to be more rice controls or whatever it might be. I mean, how is this? Because you've got to have sort of the humans to provide that insight, and that insight presumably has to be deeper and better than your next nearest competitor to maintain that competitive advantage.
Absolutely. The variety of skills that and let's say knowledge that you need nowadays is definitely much bigger and broader than it's always been in the past. And, you know, you need people that can make sense of geopolitical events and can flag you the direction to take, or the constraints that you need to input in your model, and what it makes sense to consider and what it doesn't, which is obviously, it goes back to the idea of selecting the right data that feeds your model. And you need people that obviously have an understanding of the different, for example, technologies and how disruptions may change across the different sides of the world. And, you know, if you have an LNG terminal going down, what does that mean? What's the lead time to have it back? You know, we saw it in Europe for the whole 2022. There was a combination of low hydro levels, so low hydropower production, and lots of problems at the nuclear fleet in France, which was, a major issue that lasted for the whole year. At the same time, what you need is a new set of expertise on the weather side. So now you need weather experts that can tell you and interpret weather data. And then you need to combine that with the very short-term dynamics, obviously, because weather has an impact on the residual load. So the residual load, which is basically the residual demand that you have on the market, which is the one not covered by renewables. But at the same time, you have weather having an impact in terms of temperatures. And so that it's got an impact in terms of demand needs, especially in those countries where the electricity consumption is somehow related to heating or cooling, in a sense. As you can see, it's very wide, broad range of expertise that is needed, and that you need to combine in order to...
Yeah. I mean, we haven't even talked weather, right? Because again, you can't rely on the assumption that the old models are useful predictors, right? Because that's also changing so rapidly as well. I find the whole thing quite fascinating. And I'm not quite sure whether it's just because I've become really interested in it that I'm thinking that it's more volatile, or actually if we were having this conversation 20 years ago, equally, it would be, well, who was going to predict 9/11? Who was going to predict, you know, the dot-com bust? Who was going to predict the Iraq war? And perhaps these things have always been there. It's just we had this sort of strange period of a few years in the energy markets in particular, when prices were just very low. They weren't volatile. It was very stable. And there was an over-reliance on machine learning because it worked. And the world just wasn't a volatile place. And it was just, that was quite a formative experience for lots of people coming into the energy industry in the 2000s, which is really when it got started. And yeah, it's more of a perception bias than anything on my part that the world is very now hard to predict. But it seems there is that truth in there, in that you can no longer rely, you can't assume that markets are bound by geography. You can't assume that there's new participants coming in all at the same time. And then you just have these huge exogenous shocks that can come along that are incredibly hard to predict. And probably the best thing to do is, and this is why most organizations, producers, refiners, chemical companies, are all either doing or thinking about how to strengthen their marketing and trading capabilities, because you just need to be able to manage risk in this environment.
It's all very right. And I can add you another layer of complexity, which is basically, it's time related. How you pair, you know, the different time frames, you know, the short term, which is heavily impacted, as you said, by weather phenomena and the volatility connected to that, which is definitely much higher compared to the past. And the volatility of global phenomena that they are to predict, and their magnitude is, the scale is definitely higher than the past. But you cannot ignore the mid and the long term, especially the mid term. And we have seen it over the past, let's say, 12 to 18 months, how a lot of companies, which were champions of the energy transition over the past 10 years, you know, multiple of examples of company moving from one market to another and becoming the new champion in that space, they're now facing humongous challenges because of that, because the focus was effectively on the short-term dynamic and the very long-term, but there was not the micro aspect of the mid-term. And it's become very complex, and also the edging component becoming more and more of a challenge, but at the same time an opportunity. It's not the case that we're starting to see a lot of mid to long term, let's say, contracts coming back, also in spaces where, like the power market with power purchasing agreements. So you start having, you know, those 5 to 10 years contract that can help you lock in, obviously, renewable generation on one side and green procurement on the other side, and shield you from that volatility, which is an opportunity for traders, but a nightmare for industries and consumers.
And there's also, and this is a entirely different story as well, is that there's a sense that the traders are underappreciated for managing that volatility, right? The sort of the press, particularly in the UK, is often filled with X company made X millions trading X, you know, as opposed to the story about, well, where would Europe have been without the trading community willing to take that risk and manage that volatility? But that's another discussion. Well, it's been fascinating. I kind of love to have you back on again in a year or so and sort of see where we are. But it'd be great to get, you know, obviously ICIS is in the business of providing this insight and analytics and intelligence to clients. So by all means, please give us a couple of words on your role in the company.
More than happy to do that. So I'm, say, leading a team of analysts and quants at ICAS that we look specifically at the energy world, so with a global level. We launched last year a new program of work, which is called Energy Foresight, which effectively tries to address all these different challenges, combining different techniques in terms of forecasting tools and linking different models that look at different markets. So having, you know, a weather model that feeds into a power and gas model, the carbon model, which is the overarching one that, let's say, somehow shows you the direction of the energy transition, an LNG module, which feeds into the different gas models that we have, and they all look together with the idea of trying to get the complexity and get that sum, which is more than the sum of the single parts, in a sense.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, Matteo, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for coming on, and look forward to having you back on in the future.
You too. Thanks again, Paul.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to support the show, please give us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
To find out more about HC Insider and HC Group, a search and advisory firm dedicated to the commodity markets, visit our website at www.hcgroup.global. There you can find out more about our services and our offices around the world. There you can also find more content, from interviews to insight pieces to more podcasts focused on the commodity value chains. Thanks again for listening.